Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. With the average price of a house at about $173,000 and the average monthly rent of $1,300, Pennsylvania is considered one of the most affordable housing markets in the country. However, that doesn't mean everyone can afford to buy a house or to pay rent. There are other issues that make housing an issue in Pennsylvania. Issues like availability of multifamily or low-income housing and discrimination. Housing is the topic on today's Smart Talk. Joining us is Phyllis Chamberlain, Executive Director of the Housing Alliance of Pennsylvania. Tim Whalen, Executive Director of the Cumberland County Housing and Redevelopment Authority. Kirk Stoner, Director of Planning for Cumberland County. And Regina Mitchell, Executive Director of the York Housing Authority. Welcome to everyone to the program today.
Great. Thank you for having us.
Good morning.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Phyllis Chamberlain, let me start with you, because you do have that statewide vision of this. Describe Pennsylvania's housing market right now.
Sure. Well, good morning, and thanks for having me. Every community is certainly different, but at the same time, with the issue of affordable housing, communities across the state actually have a lot of common challenges. The problem is that there's a severe shortage of housing units, rental housing units, that are available and affordable to the lowest income households. And for those at the very bottom of the income spectrum, including those making minimum wage, the shortage is actually the most severe. For every 100 households that are making on average $26,000 or $27,000 annually, there's only 42 units that are available and affordable to them. The lack of units that are affordable to them means that a vast majority of low-income households have to pay a pretty high percentage of their monthly income for rent. And that means that they don't have enough income left over to pay basic necessities such as food, daycare if they have children, and they often can't afford an unexpected medical bill or car repair, which means that it's very easy to fall behind on rent. And when we look at the elderly and people with disabilities, I think we can all agree that they deserve the opportunity to live in the community and for the elderly to age in place in their home. And in too many cases, there's a lack of accessible housing, which is a fairly large challenge across the state. And for people who are aging, they may not have enough money to make repairs to their home, including accessibility modifications that would allow them to remain in their home instead of going into a pretty costly nursing home.
So there are a lot of issues, and we're going to discuss many of those and see if, here other areas of the state and here in central Pennsylvania region. One thing before we do go to our other guest, you mentioned a higher percentage of income for low-income people that goes to housing. What is the recommended percentage that a person's income or a family's income is to go toward housing?
Standard is that a family should only pay 30% of their income for rent, because by paying that amount, they're able to have somewhat adequate funds to pay other basic necessities.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Tim Whalen, you are the Executive Director of the Cumberland County Housing and Redevelopment Authority. And just to let our listeners know, to provide some context here, some background, one of the reasons we decided to do this program is that Cumberland County recently hosted a housing summit. Let's start with the reason for the summit and then get into some of the issues that Ms. Chamberlain brought up.
Yep. We did this summit for many of the same reasons that Phyllis was just talking about. And you'll hear from Kirk and our other and Regina here in a little bit about their particular issues. We did it because we are seeing this shortage of affordable housing in Cumberland and in Perry counties. So when Phyllis was talking about this rent-burdened households, which I think is one of those key statistics that every community needs to be tracking, but in Cumberland County, 43.6% of the renters in Cumberland County are considered cost burden, meaning they're paying more than 30% of their household income towards just rent. And in Cumberland County, it's of that, you know, that group of 43%, there's almost 17% of those are paying 50% or more of their income in rental housing.
Wow.
Yes. And so you can imagine, and this is one of the reasons why we felt the summit was so important, was to highlight these kinds of struggles, because there are not enough rental units, in particular for those folks that that Phyllis was pointing out, that really need deep subsidies in order to be able to maintain a good, safe, decent place to live.
We're going to get into some specifics, but generally at the summit, you had a number of speakers that had a lot of information, but generally, what did you find?
Yeah, what we found is that in the grand scheme of things, and you know, Phyllis will reinforce this and others, Cumberland County, we're doing okay. But the opportunities that Cumberland County has before it, where we need to grow, where we need to develop, how we need to create new housing in the county, is a lot of why we had the summit, to look at, yes, we have struggles, but we also have great opportunities in the county, and we need to go about meeting those opportunities.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, we have our representatives from Cumberland County and York County, but many of the things we're talking about, if not all or most of them, hold true across Pennsylvania. So from what you're hearing today, just think, if you're not living in one of the counties where we have a panelist from, just think about this, that it is pretty much representative of all the whole region or throughout Pennsylvania. But Regina Mitchell, let's talk about York County. You've heard a couple things that I've noticed you nodding in agreement with what you've heard. A lot of these things the same in York County, or is there anything unique?
In York County, we are finding the same struggles. But one of the things that we've come up with is that the quality of our affordable housing is deteriorating, so that our families are living in less standard housing than we would prefer. Not only is it less standard, they are rent burden. So that means that they're paying a lot more for less housing just to be close to their jobs or their family or schools. And that's a struggle, because when we look at statistically, lead-based paint has become an issue in York County. Lead in the water, which the city is now working to fix. All of those areas impact not necessarily the housing, but the children and the families in which we serve. So we're looking at ways in which to increase the housing stock, improve the housing stock, both in the city and in the county, and to work with our partners, whether it's for-profit developers, nonprofit developers, whatever it takes, in seizing the opportunities to increase affordable housing and quality affordable housing.
All right, let's talk about that quality for just a moment. When there is lead-based paint in a property where someone is living, I'm assuming that is probably an older property. Is that true? And do you have an average idea or an idea of what the average age of your rental properties are, your affordable rental properties?
And we have two different kind of housing stocks that I actually manage. We have our voucher program, which is the landlords. It's owned by private landlords. And then the Housing Authority also owns probably about 1,200 units. When you talk about lead-based paint, anything older or built before 1978 has lead-based in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that we have to watch for. If we get a report from the school that says a child that's living in that unit has elevated lead levels in their blood system, then we have to test the unit. We have to go in and with contractors, Qualified contractors is to test a unit to see if the unit is producing the elevated lead in the child.
Shouldn't that be done anyway?
Yes, we do it on a regular basis, but normally what happens is we paint over everything, and we paint and we paint and we paint, and then it's that little speck of paint that gets under five layers that you never see in the back of the closet that can actually have that issue. So we work really hard and really diligently on making sure that all of our units are lead-free.
Mm. Kirk Stoner, you're the director of planning in Cumberland County. Where does planning come into this? Because I have to admit that probably most people, when you ask them what the planning commission or the planning department does in a county, will talk about housing developers, single-family housing developments, or trying to cut down on sprawl, or smart growth, that kind of thing. But what they may not think about, the general public that is where affordable housing is going to be located. And let's face it, there is some pushback very often when there is low-income housing, high-density apartments that are proposed, because there are a lot of people say, not in my backyard. So where does planning come in on all this?
Sure. It's a good point, Scott, because what we do see with our communities as we're doing our comprehensive planning, we need to be looking at all aspects of the community, economic development, transportation, and housing all together. And I think historically what we've seen is that housing has been looked at in its own silo and really hasn't been integrated into the rest of the community. So I think as planners, we need to figure out where our housing is located, but also more importantly, where our jobs are located, to make sure that there's not a disconnect between where people are living and where they're working. And I think if you even look regionally, you see that there is that disconnect in place, and we lack the public transportation or the transportation resources to make the connection between where people are living and where they're working. And that income component is just as important as the supply component on affordable housing. I mean, we're looking at the supply, the number of units, but a person's wealth and their ability to afford housing is another huge component that we need to look at. So we need to look at jobs and where those jobs are looking at, and more importantly, how much are those jobs paying? And in Cumberland County, for instance, our top five industries that comprise over 50% of our employment, three of those industries pay under $30,000 per year in average annual wages. So when you look at the affordability, that's not buying you much, and that's the type of jobs that were created in the county. So we need to look at housing in the context of a lot of other variables, economic development being one of those.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and again, you just kind of summarized with what I was thinking when you said that there are a lot of other components to it. These things are all intertwined. And, you know, you've all talked about, location, how close you are to your job and that kind of thing. But Cumberland County in particular, how do I put it, that over the years there has been a number of proposals made for, like, rail, for example. A lot of people referred to it as light rail. Mm-hmm. I don't think that was exactly accurate, but that the county actually turned it down. There is public transportation in Carlisle and in Cumberland County, but you know, do you need more?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when you look at the transportation, there's transportation available, but for that transportation to be efficient and work, we need land use densities that can support it, and we need concentrations of commercial and industrial development to support it. So you look at Cumberland County, I mean, we're nodes of small communities with a lot of space in between where we don't see residential densities that can support transportation. So we need to look beyond that and then figure out, as we're doing our new developments, can we increase density? Can we increase the heights of the building so we get more concentrations of folks in one location so that we can make our public transit more efficient? It gets back to what you said, though. As soon as we talk about more density, as soon as we talk about larger buildings, I think we get a lot of pushback from residents who are very comfortable with what they have now and aren't really looking to see the needs of their neighbors in the community. You know, I think there's probably an attitude out there, after I've got mine, I really don't care what others have or what they get. I think we need to move away from that and realize that we need a wide spectrum of housing in our communities to meet all the income requirements of our residents.
But, you know, and let me just push back against that for a moment, because there will be people who say, listen, I'm not being selfish. I chose to build a home, buy a home in this location, mm-hmm. suburbs, out in the country, for a reason, that I like this. And you're talking about major changes here.
Sure. And I think just as it's their right to live in that area, I think it's the right of the folks with lower income or looking for a smaller house. It's their right too, to live in that same community. And we need to make sure that there's opportunities for everybody.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. By the way, you know WITF has a pick of the month where we partner with Midtown Scholar Bookstore. On that pick of the month, you can read along with us, discover books that we think you'll like. I want to point out April's pick. It is The Presidents by Brian Lamb. Yes, Brian Lamb of C-SPAN and Susan Swain. It's available on April 23rd. It makes a case, actually makes a list of the best to the worst presidents in the United States. It's based on interviews collected over the author's decades, long tenures at C-SPAN. And both the authors, Lamb and Swain, will be at Midtown Scholar Bookstore on Sunday, April 28th from 4 to 6 p.m. for a book signing and discussion. And I'll be moderating that discussion on the 28th from 4 to 6 p.m. Go to WITF.org and I was about to say give now because I'm used to fundraising last week, but no, go to RSVP and you can attend the event. But I'm reading the book right now and it's very interesting. I know we have a lot of history buffs out there, but I don't think it's a big surprise who's ranked number one. It's Abraham Lincoln, but I'm not going to give away all the rest of it, but I think you'd find it interesting. On today's program, we are talking about housing in Pennsylvania, specifically affordable housing. But that includes rent, that includes owning a home, that includes discrimination. There's a lot of factors that go into housing issues here in Pennsylvania. Our guest today, Phyllis Chamberlain, Executive Director of the Housing Alliance of Pennsylvania, Regina Mitchell, Executive Director of the York Housing Authority, Kirk Stoner, Director of Planning for Cumberland County, and Tim Whalen, Executive Director of the Cumberland County Housing and Redevelopment Authority. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Phyllis Chamber, let me come back to you. And by the way, everyone just join in here in our conversation. But Phyllis, as I'm hearing, income is obviously an issue. You mentioned it, and our other panelists have mentioned it as well. Right now, there is a proposal to increase Pennsylvania's minimum wage. It is $7.25 an hour. Governor Wolf has proposed increasing it to $12 an hour, eventually getting it up to $15 an hour. Would that make a difference in the housing issues that Pennsylvania, especially low-income Pennsylvanians, are facing?
Increasing the wages that people earn certainly would make a difference. We at the Housing Alliance focus on increasing the subsidies available to help people pay rent because we know from evidence across the state and from communities across the nation that when a person has a stable place to live, they're able to have the stability that they need to go back to school if that's what they want to do, to get a better job that pays a higher income. So our focus is really on increasing the assistance to low-income households to pay rent, and it's also on increasing investment from the private sector to help housing developers build more affordable units because housing is a stabilizing force that can help people get a better job, increase their income. It also turns out that housing is a stabilizing force to help people improve their health and for children to succeed in school.
When you say improve their health and succeed in school, what do you mean?
So if you think about it, a child who doesn't have a stable place has more difficulty studying for school. And there's actually quite a bit of research that shows that a lack of safe and stable housing impacts children's health and educational outcomes. There's one study that showed that living in poor quality housing and disadvantaged neighborhoods is associated with lower kindergarten readiness scores. And once a child gets behind, it's often pretty difficult for them to catch back up. There's also evidence that poor housing quality is actually associated with higher rates of depression, anxiety, and aggression from elementary school through young adulthood. So we focus on housing because people need a roof over their heads, but it turns out that the lack of a safe, stable, affordable place to live can actually impact children for over the long term.
So this is more than just a housing issue to you. It is a social issue.
Absolutely.
Since we were talking about health, I understand that another challenge that everyone faces, I shouldn't say everyone, that there are a number of people who face, are those who may be suffering from mental illness and those who have been addicted to a substance, that housing for people in those situations is particularly difficult. Phyllis Mitchell, what about in York? Is that are those two challenges that you see?
Yes, it is. It's a challenge that we all see throughout the state and throughout the nation, that a lot of our senior housing or affordable, what we call our disabled and senior housing, actually houses several residents with mental health issues. We, as a housing provider, try to partner with our local agencies to get their supportive services in, to help them live successfully independently. That is the goal for us, to make sure that our residents live successfully independent. Whether it's through using other social services, York is actually very fortunate. We have in-house social service support that we use to with referrals, making sure that residents have access to their needed local agencies that can help them. We see it more and more as state hospitals and other institutions have closed down. Affordable housing saw the influx of it, and we're doing our best to make sure that our residents, again, are living successfully in that environment.
Phyllis Chamberlain, and let me just turn back to you for a moment. You know, what Regina Mitchell just described often leads to homelessness for many people. Now, many communities in this state, many agencies, organizations in this state have tackled the homelessness problem head on, some more successful than others. But homelessness, I would assume, continues to be a problem here in Pennsylvania, and for just a couple of the reasons that that Regina just described.
That is correct, that there are many good programs that are serving homeless households at the local level, but the numbers of people experiencing homelessness are not decreasing quickly enough. And what we've been talking about, the housing affordability crisis, is the main reason for homelessness.
And a lot of kids, too. When you were talking about children who, if they don't have a stable roof over their heads, that they have problems in school, I think it would amaze a lot of people, would surprise a lot of people, the number of homeless kids in this state.
That's right. And the research that I mentioned earlier, there's also research about children who are homeless who have been shown to have even more significant health problems, which also leads to behavior issues and problems with academic achievement.
So, Tim Whalen, I know part of the Housing Summit addressed private and public partnerships. Just a few minutes ago, Phyllis mentioned that of trying to get the private sector involved in building more low-income or more housing that would help to solve some of this problem. Tell us about how it's working, some of the experiences that Cumberland County has.
Yep. We call it the in Pennsylvania, they have the low-income housing tax credit that's made available to Pennsylvania developers to facilitate them having some of the costs underwritten for creating affordable housing. It is an incredibly competitive program here in Pennsylvania. So the current round that is should be announced, late spring, early summer this year, there were about more than 85 applications received for doing that. We participated.
From contractors, builders?
From developers. We participated in two of those. So we have two applications in, so that we're waiting on that. But we also know from talking to our friends at the Pennsylvania Housing Finance Administration that only one of three will probably actually be funded.
Mm. One of the, and Kirk, I'll turn to you as our planner on our panel today, but I understand that one of the challenges you face in that area is that sometimes developers don't see a return on the investment that they want. So sometimes they are hesitant. Maybe that's why, you know, a tax credit is needed, but they are hesitant to invest in this because they don't see the kind of investment or the return on their investment that they would with, say, a single family development.
Sure. I think you're spot on that, you know, the development community is looking for a return on their investment, whether it be a single family development or a multifamily development. So I think some of the programs that Tim's mentioning, the tax credits, help. But in our research and our work with our partners from the Realtors Association and Builders Association, I think looking at some common sense solutions at the municipal level as well of increasing density to allow more units to be built provides more units on the market, which helps affordability, but it also helps profitability on their side. So I think there's some of those solutions where we need to look for the win-win that the private sector is engaged and wants to participate because there is a return, but at the same time, we're building more units. As we've discussed this morning, we see that lack of number of units is really driving some of our affordability issues.
Let's take a few of our emails that we've received. Grace in Lancaster says, part of the affordability problem is when a longtime homeowner of a two or more family, she's talking about herself, as a homeowner of a two or more family homes, the long-term renters are often evicted. Their home is taken away through no fault of their own. What can be done to cut down on these evictions? Now, we do know that during the Great Recession 10 years ago and the couple years after that this was a real big problem. Seems to have slowed down somewhat, but still, the issue that she brings up about renters that are losing the place that they live, what can be done about that? Who'd like to take that one?
Yeah, I think the first thing is we need more monies to subsidize renters, especially those low-income renters, and there are just not sufficient funds. So the Housing Choice Voucher program that is available throughout the country, we administer it for both Cumberland and Perry counties. There are very long waiting lists. Right now, if you filled out an application today and submitted it to us, it would be 18 months to 2 years before your name would come to the top of the list. That's the kind of subsidies that are needed in order to help keep people in their homes.
Mm-hmm. Emily writes, I'm 26 and work in food service management. My fiance is a foundry worker. We don't make a lot, but we can pay our bills. I currently rent an apartment right outside of Lancaster City. My fiance and I are hoping to buy a home in the city early last year. It turns out we were too late because prices in the city shot up right around then and haven't gone down. We gave up after about 6 months of looking. I've permanently given up any hope of owning a home outside of something silly like winning the lottery. And says, I hear you have to play to win. She's right there. My fiance still holds out hope. Lancaster City is having a serious boom, and it's been great for those at the top, but bad for us at the bottom. So we're kind of in this email kind of transitions us into being able to buy and afford a home. We know that there has been a lot of change in the last 10 years. Where are we right now for those who are in Emily's situation? She says they don't make a lot. She doesn't say how much. But the dream of owning a home is becoming something of just that, a dream and not reality. Let me turn to Phyllis on that first, and we'll go from there.
There is a program at the state level called FARE. The acronym is P-H-A-R-E. And it's a very popular program that's been used all across the state. And it provides assistance not just for homeowners, but for renters too. It's a program that's administered by the Pennsylvania Housing Finance Agency. And the groups that are helping people with with assistance for housing can apply and have more resources to be able to help people like the woman whose story you were just sharing. So it really goes back to what Tim already said, that we need to increase the resources that are available to help local organizations help more people, whether they need rental housing or whether they need homeownership options. And because my organization works at the state level, our focus is on increasing the resources available so that local organizations can assist more people, like through the FAIR program.
Mm-hmm. Isn't this a supply and demand issue as well? I mean, we often, when we look at the data from real estate, of realtors and real estate, we often see that the number of houses that are on the market, how many have sold recently, how many have been built, the prices, whether they've gone up. But I kind of go back to just what everyone is saying here, is that incomes haven't kept up with those prices, those rents as well. Tim, would you agree with that?
I agree wholeheartedly with that, Scott, that we are seeing huge income disparities, and that's part of the reason why we're seeing increases in homelessness, why we're seeing increases in people on our waiting lists. We have a first-time home buyer program. We've received money
in Cumberland County.
In Cumberland County, that we get monies through the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. We have a goodly amount of money in there, $130,000. It sounds like a lot, but yet it's not enough for all the people who would potentially qualify for down payment and closing cost assistance, like the family you just that you just talked about there.
Regina, something similar in your county?
And it's similar. We have the same programs through other local agencies, but I want to fall back on what Phyllis said about the demographics of who we serve and who is being hurt the most in this market. It's the person who is working, the family who's on the email who's working. They don't quite make enough, but they need assistance. And they sit way outside of any assistance, maybe to get child care, Medicaid, other social, what we call safety net programs. And their housing is suffering because they need to make sure they have medical coverage. They need to make sure they have food. And our programs through the voucher program, our public housing, our tax credit programs actually become that safety net so that it allows people to rise up and be able to save for that down payment or to find better housing. But Phyllis hit it that we need to work on the finding more affordable mechanisms to help families, especially working families, to rise up with the economic increases that we're seeing in the areas that so that they can afford good housing and live in good neighborhoods where their schools are rated high. We work hard to make sure that our residents get those kind of opportunities.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Listen, tomorrow on Smart Talk, our guest will be State Auditor General Eugene DePasquale. We'll be talking about the high cost of prescription drugs, and also he has some good news about the backlog of rape kits throughout Pennsylvania. Visit our website. You can get an outlook of conversations we're working on. Plus, you can leave a voicemail or a voice memo question for one of our upcoming programs. More information is at WITF.org/smarttalk. Today, we're talking about housing in Pennsylvania. And I know we're jumping around to a lot of different topics, but there is a lot there, and that's one of the reasons that we're doing that. Our guest today, Tim Whalen, Executive Director of the Cumberland County Housing and Redevelopment Authority, Kirk Stoner, Director of Planning with Cumberland County, Regina Mitchell, Executive Director of the York Housing Authority, and Phyllis Chamberlain, Executive Director of the Housing Alliance of Pennsylvania. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. 929-7532. Thomas sends us an email saying, I'm an investor in real estate in Lancaster City. All of my properties are leased with the Public Housing Voucher Program, but I also have to say that the government needs to pay market rate for rent. I feel that this is keeping many low-income residents from finding affordable housing. Also, gentrification of neighborhoods also driving low-income residents into homelessness. It's great to rehabilitate buildings, but at the same time, after the rehab is done, the rents are out of reach for low income. Let me start with Regina and talk about the city of York and York County and the things that Thomas brought up.
One of the things that we've been discussing a lot in York is gentrification. Downtown is seeing some really nice redevelopment of some of the historical buildings of the York City. But we are also seeing an exodus of low-income families leaving the area. So how do we actually come up with a solution that keeps families in the neighborhood and allow for the buildings and the communities to also see redevelopment opportunities? It's a conversation that is local. It's not a national conversation, but it's where communities sit down with the developers and the city leaders and talk about what they want for their neighborhood. Oftentimes, we have community meetings, but we have no one at the community meeting to talk to. I encourage people to get involved in their communities, get a voice about what's going on in your neighborhood so that you know what's going on and that you share your concerns and your ideas of your neighborhood.
Kirk, as a planner, is this something taken into consideration? I mean, as Regina just said, that there are very few people showing up at the meetings. And we know that unless there's a big controversy, often meetings, planning commission meetings, almost any kind of meeting, aren't well attended. But when people are being driven from their homes, I mean, afterwards, we have most people who are looking and say, oh, look at this. We've redeveloped this area. Isn't it nice looking? Isn't it really great that we've kept the historic aspect to it, that's bringing people into the city? But a lot of young people who want to move into the city because of the entertainment value, being close to, being able to walk and that kind of thing. But we don't hear about the people that it's driving out.
No, Scott, I think you're right. We see this consistently, and through my experience in working with a lot of our core communities throughout the county, being our boroughs that are more densely developed, where you're seeing a lot of mixed uses, and you're also seeing some property values and housing prices that are a little lower and more affordable. So we see redevelopment initiatives come in, and exactly what you said, we want to see higher property values, new bars and restaurants, and new, luxury apartments. And at the same time as that redevelopment happens, we're seeing folks leave the community. And I think, as we're doing that planning, we need to keep in mind that our communities really need to be a mix of people of different backgrounds and races and a mix of different incomes, so that as we're doing our redevelopment, we don't want it to gentrification to happen so that then we only have one income level and we only have one type of housing, and then the rest of the folks are pushed further out and maybe pushed away from their jobs. And again, coming back to some of the transportation issues, that they can't find a job that they can get to.
Mm-hmm. Phyllis, let me ask you, mentioned the word discrimination, and it sounds as if something that we know that it happened a lot in Pennsylvania's past, not just Pennsylvania, but throughout the country. But there are laws against discriminating today when it comes to housing, but it still continues to be an issue. And in fact, in the Cumberland County survey, so we heard that there are still issues of discrimination out there. How much of an issue is this in Pennsylvania?
Discrimination is still a fairly large problem, and when we talk about discrimination, it isn't just about race and ethnicity. There are people that have criminal records who are returning to the community and are often screened out because of that criminal record. There's evidence that if people with criminal records don't have stable housing, that they don't have the stability that they need, and it doesn't help them not commit a crime again. So there are other reasons why people discriminate. If people have evictions, they or and poor credit, which many low-income households do have on their records, those are also reasons that they may not be able to obtain affordable housing.
But is that discrimination? I mean, let's face it, you have people who own a property. They want to make sure that the rent is paid.
Correct, right. And certainly there are reasons that landlords may choose not to rent to them. But the problem is that if people aren't given an opportunity and aren't able to access stable housing, it doesn't help them for all the reasons that we've been talking about today. There are actually a number of programs that focus on building partnerships with landlords, because landlords, as you just said, are making choices that they need to make to ensure the safety of their other residents. But there are actually a number of service providers that work with landlords to help them keep their tenants stably housed.
The three of you here in the studio, discrimination a problem?
Yeah, I think I see it from an unintentional discrimination sometimes by our municipalities. They control our land use through their powers to zone. And in many cases, they may not be aware of some of the affordable or even workforce housing issues that are out there as they're compiling their zoning ordinance or making their zoning maps. So some municipalities may unintentionally zone out certain land uses or put them in the wrong location and really not realize the broader impacts of their local zoning decisions. So I think it's an awareness issue with our municipalities so that they're aware of how integral housing is to every other element of their community.
Mm-hmm. But Regina, what about outright discrimination, a landlord not renting to someone because of a racial background or maybe a criminal background or, any number of reasons?
There's a number of reasons, but outright discrimination, we're not seeing it as an uptick in it. But what we are seeing in York are landlords not willing to accept the voucher program, who say that
Thomas described a few minutes ago.
And they advertise, no Section 8 accepted. So that just says, I'm not accepted here. I'm not wanted here. We at York, we encourage our landlords. We want to work with our landlords to actually increase landlord participation so that we can increase the quality of housing. We want to, whether the programs actually guarantees you your rent every month. That's what the voucher program does to our landlords. We pay by the third of each month our portion of the rent for our participants. So this gives us the opportunity, if we reach out and landlords really look in and try to understand the program, that we are good partners and we want good landlords.
Let me ask you this, and I almost hesitate to ask some of these questions because it sounds as if I'm taking the side of those who have decided, but these are things that we know exist out there. That I'm sure that one of the reasons that there are landlords who say that they don't want to take Section 8, the voucher program, participate in that program, is that they say that the people who have rented have not kept care of the properties, that the properties are not in good shape afterwards. And we know this is not universal. I'm just pointing out something that I'm sure some of them would say. Is there anything to ensure that who is living there make sure that they do take care of the property and that, that it's someone that it's going to be in the same shape it was in, if not better, than when they leave?
And I support our participants of the voucher programs. 90% of them are good people. They take care of the property. It's that small minority
that gets the attention.
But I tell the landlords who often call my office complaining about one of the participants, I often tell them that they have the most power in their hands is when they have their lease. They have a lease with that landlord participant. Use your lease and invoke your lease. If they're not abiding by the lease, do like we do with our public housing and take them and go through the legal process. But there is ways that they can enforce their lease.
We have an email here from Beth who says, it's not so much a crisis as much as greed. I've been homeless since February 4th. I have one eviction and only one eviction in my entire life. I'm finding that a lot of apartment complexes tell me the minute I say that, yes, I have one eviction, even though it was one eviction my entire life, they say, we can't rent you. However, I see them advertising the same apartment since February. It cost anywhere between $25 to $45 per person over 18 years old to put an application in for an apartment. There was one apartment I had to pay $35 per person, and there's three of us to apply for the apartment before I was even allowed to look at the apartment. That doesn't go far. She makes $1,600 a month to stay in a hotel. Oh, wait, let me just read this again because it's a long email and I'm jumping around. I've been paying over $1,600 a month just to stay in a hotel to keep us off the streets. That doesn't go far when my total monthly income right now is $2,400 a month. I can only afford to apply for one or two apartments a month. What can a person like this do?
That is really at the heart of a lot of the struggles that we find with people needing subsidies and needing a hand in getting housing in our community. I think the first off, that, you know, for Beth, that she needs to make sure that she's in contact with the local coordinated entry system in her county. So that can be as simple as dialing 211, and there will be people who will start to work with her to help her get into housing. It's not easy because there are long waiting lists wherever you look. But that's a place where, you know, the advocacy of people who work with homelessness in our community can help stand beside Beth and talk to landlords, get her into a good quality place. But you know, it's not easy. There's too many people in similar circumstances.
To use a cliche, she's between a rock and a hard place. $1,600 a month to stay in a hotel, which would pay rent for probably a nice, or, you know, a quality rental property, correct?
Correct.
Sure.
Yeah, that's so, Beth, you know, try to take advantage of what Tim just mentioned, and see what you can do there. Let's see. We have also, I want to make sure we get to Barbara. Barbara says, while I was searching for housing in New York County, I toured a rental in Dallastown that I considered to be a death trap. Knob and tube electricity, original to 1927, actively peeling lead paint, missing window screens. Obviously didn't rent the unit, called the borough's office repeatedly about the dangerous home, was told the borough only inspects rental housing every other year, and none of the issues I mentioned were on the list of things they inspect for. Was told that lead paint coordinator in New York City told me there are only 12 or 13 municipalities in the entire state that have lead paint ordinances. This sounds like a real problem, if that's accurate. Is it accurate?
Yeah, it's accurate. You know, that is the type of place that was just described is not a rental unit that would pass our housing quality standards. So when people receive a voucher for our different programs or other assistance programs, those apartments and units are inspected. We inspect for things like lead-based paint. We inspect for electrical safety and other safety conditions. That sounds like apartment that would not pass our inspection, and so consequently we would not allow our voucher to be used for such a property.
Thomas wrote back and said, one last comment. Is the public aware of PAHousingSearch.com? It's a government program where landlords can list properties for Section 8 and non-Section 8 low-income housing. It's free for landlords and tenants.
Is that great resource.
Great resource?
Great resource. Yep. Landlords should use it. Participants, even people who don't have vouchers but are looking for affordable housing can also use the resource. So it has a lot of resources, and even I think it has some social service, so like 211, it will direct you to your local 211. So it's a great resource. I agree with them. Mm-hmm.
Phyllis Chamberlain, we have less than a minute to go. If you could kind of summarize what's needed to improve the housing situation in this state.
Sure. More public and private partnerships at the local level, but more funding for the groups that are working at the local level to provide assistance to low-income households for all the reasons we discussed today, because the consequences of not helping people impact children's health, their lifetime earnings because of their lack of school achievement. There's so many reasons to address the issue of affordable housing. It's really about people's quality of life over the long term.
Phyllis Chamberlain, Housing Alliance of Pennsylvania, Tim Whalen, Cumberland County Housing Redevelopment Authority, Kirk Stoner, Director of Planning for Cumberland County, Regina Mitchell with the York Housing Authority. Thank all of you for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're very
welcome. Thank you.
As you can hear, this is a very complex issue. Coming up tomorrow, State Auditor General Eugene T. Pasquale is on the program.